The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
There is a correction on your study guide. I forget which question it is, but the list of modern theologians and the views. I think it's question 22 or something like that, toward the end of the of the comprehension questions. Reference to the big ditch there is gives you a wrong page number. The fellow who said that there's a big ditch between history and faith, I'm told that you can find him on page 7 of Kahn's Contemporary World Theology instead of page 41. So, but I hope some of you at least were alert enough to discover the author of the big ditch without my telling you all that. The rest of you, I'll make you look it up. Okay, here we are on the logical positivism. Some of you are visitors and coming in the middle of this. I can't imagine a worse lecture to come into the middle of, but we'll try to do our best. Basically, logical positivism asserts a certain correlation between meaning and verification. All right, a certain correlation between meaning and verification. Some of the positivists even used this slogan. They said the meaning of a sentence is the method of its verification. That is to say, if you want to find out what a sentence means, you find out how you verify it. You find out how you go about establishing it. If I say the book is on the table and I want to find out what that means, well, I'd go around and ask people how they'd prove it and how they'd disprove it. You can imagine somebody who's learning a new language, you know, going off into a tribe and trying to master a language that he hasn't heard before, and somebody uses a sentence he hasn't heard, and he says, well, now that's an interesting sentence. I've never heard that before. How is that a true sentence? And the guy says, yes, it's a true sentence. Well, how would you go about establishing that? How would you prove it if it's true? How would you disprove it if it's false? You can imagine that as one way in which we go about learning language. I think it's a little bit implausible to say that's the only way, but some of the positivists at least offered that rather extreme version of a theory of meaning, that the meaning of a sentence is the method of its verification. Now that sounds rather strange. Why would they want to limit the concept of meaning in that way? Why would they say that the only way that you can find the meaning of a sentence is by referring to its method of verification? Well, you can see how this is plausible. For instance, if somebody were to come up before you today and say he doesn't really believe in wind, he believes that when the leaves rustle outside your window at night, that's not wind blowing, that's elves having a party. Sometimes you can almost believe that, you know, but the first question you'd want to ask him is, look, how do you verify that? How can you show me that there are elves making those sounds in the trees? Now, at least at first, it seems as though that sentence is perfectly meaningful, even if it can't be verified. That's the problem we have with positivism initially. At first, it seems as though that sentence is perfectly meaningful. You know what it means for elves to be making noises in trees. You may not think that it's right. You don't think that's a right explanation for the sounds, but you can understand the meaning. And so why is it that you'd connect the meaning of that sentence so narrowly with its verification? Well, the point is this, I think. This is what carries such great weight with the positivists. If you can't show how to verify that, or how to falsify it, to take the alternative approach. If you cannot show how to verify it or how to falsify it, then you can't show what difference it makes in the world. All right, that's the crucial point. If you can't show how to verify it or how to falsify it, You can't show what difference it makes in the world. Now, let's say somebody said, well, I can verify the presence of elves in the trees, because whenever those sounds are made in the leaves, I can tune in on my CB radio on a very special channel and hear a high-pitched chattering, and they're talking to one another about which leaf to move next and so on. Well, that would be a way of verifying, you see. And so you can show how your theory differs from the wind theory, how the elf theory differs from the wind theory. You can show that the elves really do make a difference because they can be picked up on the CB radio. They make sounds on the CB radio, so you can verify it that way. For instance, you said, well, I verify it because when I look up in the trees, I see an eerie yellow glow there, and that indicates the presence of elves. Well, it might indicate other things, too. But nevertheless, that would be, you know, a kind of concrete difference. You say, well, the difference between the elf theory and the wind theory is that on the elf theory, you'd expect to see an eerie yellow glow in the trees. And as a matter of fact, you do see that. You can detect it when those sounds are made. Well, through those methods of verification, then, you can show what difference it makes to believe in the elves as over against believing in wind. Now, you have to remember that maybe the difference is no more than that, you know. Maybe it's just that the guy who talks about elves is really talking about strange sounds on a CB radio, and the guy who talks about elves may be talking simply about a strange yellow glow that appears to him. But at least he's talking about something that makes a difference from the established theory. Now, if a guy says, look, there's no way to verify it, it's impossible to tell what difference it makes. It appears as though the two theories really don't describe any factual differences in the world. They're simply using different words to describe the same thing. All right, the one guy talks about wind, the other guy doesn't like to use that particular word, so he uses the word elf, but they're really referring to the same data. Their language really does not differ in meaning. So that you can see now, I think, how the positivist theory becomes plausible. It becomes plausible to say that without verification, you can't show the difference between two theories, and without showing a difference, you can't show it. Without showing a difference in fact, you can't show a difference in meaning between the two theories. So now, when flu comes along, and we see that flu problem that we were talking about briefly yesterday, when flu comes along, and he says, "Look, there's really doesn't seem to be any difference between the Christian hypothesis and the atheist hypothesis. The atheist says there's no God. The Christian says that there is a God. But what is the difference? Well." It seems that whatever test you bring to bear is inconclusive, and there's no way of distinguishing between the two on the basis of tests. The unbeliever says there's no God, the Christian, and he brings all kinds of evidence for his assertion that there is no God. He says, look, if God existed, there wouldn't be any evil in the world. The Christian says, well, you know, evil bothers me. Evil is a problem to the Christian faith, but it doesn't falsify the truth of Christianity. I can believe in God even though there is evil, just as Job did, even though God brought all kinds of judgments all kinds of trials and tribulations upon Job. Nevertheless, Job remained firm in his faith in God, and the Christian takes that same kind of attitude. Well, okay, so the unbeliever brings in a pile of other evidence. He says, well, look, the Bible has been shown to be contradictory. It's been shown to be lacking in truth and so on and so forth. All of modern scholarship agrees, you know, that these books were not written by the people that whose names they bear and so on and so forth on down the line. The Christian says, well, I just don't accept that evidence. I don't believe that this evidence is based on the right presuppositions. I don't believe that a really honest, open-minded survey of the, you know, whichever apologetic method you want to use. But anyway, you reject that evidence. And so the unbeliever says, well, look, if your God is a God who exists even in the face of all this evil that exists in the world, if your God exists even in the face of all this, all of these strange data in the Bible, and so on and so forth. Really, it seems to me that there isn't much difference between believing in God and not believing in God. You know, the world is pretty much the same on either alternative. And you're just using the word God to describe what we unbelievers talk about as no God. You're using God while we would use chance or fate or chaos, an old knight, or something like that. Have to keep the old knight in there. All right, what can we say about this? First thing to remember is that, and by the way, this is all in the article that I wrote, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this. I'd like to spend more time explaining it, but just to summarize at least my response to this positivist challenge, first of all, Christianity does claim to be verifiable in terms of its own presuppositions. And, you know, Christians do claim that the gospel is verified by evidence. And we talked about that in part two of the course when we were discussing epistemology, that there's a sense in which the Christian evidence proves the Christian norms. There's a sense in which the Christian evidence proves the Christian revelation. So that we believe, you see, that the miracles of Christ, the fulfillment of prophecy, the resurrection of Christ from the dead, all have evidential value. They should, and that the gospel ought to be accepted on the basis of that testimony, on the basis of that evidence. Scripture presents that as evidence, and so we ought to regard it as evidence too. And so we claim that Christianity is verifiable. Furthermore, we claim that therefore there is a difference, that Christianity makes a difference. If the God of the Bible does not exist, then nothing could exist. If the God of the Bible doesn't exist, then you would have chaos and old night. If the God of the Bible doesn't exist, then reasoning and thinking and all the activities that we carry on day by day would have no meaning, would have no purpose, and in fact couldn't be carried on at all. That God is the sine qua non, the necessary condition of any activity that we carry on in this world that he's made. So that if God did not exist, everything would be different. It's not just that some things would be different. If God did not exist, everything would be different. But furthermore, we have to say that, recognize that Christianity is not verifiable in terms of non-Christian presuppositions. That is, Christianity is not verifiable in terms of presuppositions which deny the gospel. Christianity is not verifiable in terms of logical positivist presuppositions. The Christian does not accept the verification criterion as a final criterion of meaning and truth. The Christian holds that God himself is the ultimate determiner of meaning, and that his word has to be taken as the supreme authority with regard to with regard to our view of language, as well as with regard to our view of other things. And although you know, there are some parallels, I think, between a Christian view of language and a positivist view of language, I think that both positions do insist that meaningful language must make a difference. But the two positions have very different ways of determining what makes a difference and determining what counts as a significant difference. The next proposition is that logical positivism is afflicted with essentially the same situation that the Christian is in, that just as the Christian makes presuppositions judges the evidence on the basis of those presuppositions, so the logical positivist does too. It's not as though the Christian is irrational, that the Christian is grasping madly by faith at something that cannot be demonstrated, whereas the logical positivist is perfectly rational and accepts only that which can be definitely shown to be true. No, quite to the contrary. Both the Christian and the positivist claim to have evidence. Both the Christian and the positivist lay claim to methods by which their theories can be verified. And also, both the Christian and the positivist have presuppositions that govern their thinking about the evidence, that govern their thinking about the nature of reality. What are Flew's presuppositions? Well, I suppose the general positivist view of language, the general concept of scientific method that he learned and so on is that the only way of determining the meaning of anything is by using the methods of natural science and by eliminating all verification by reference to revelation. Well, that's a view that's very commonly held, but it's certainly a view that doesn't have to be held. It's a view that Christians reject, as a matter of fact, but it is a presupposition. Remember when we were talking about the verification principle itself the other day, I asked the positivists, can the verification principle be verified? The answer, I think, is generally accepted today is no. The verification principle is an exception to its own rule. The verification principle falls apart on its own basis. But now, why is that? Well, the reason is that the verification principle in positivism has takes the role of a presupposition. It is a faith commitment, essentially. Now, that's what it is. And so positivism is a religion just as much as Christianity is. It has the same kind of structure that Christianity is, even though its content is quite the opposite. The next point I want to make is that logical positivism, like all non-Christian thought, is locked in a rationalist-irrationalist dialectic. When we began to consider positivism, it seemed very rationalistic. It seemed that the positivists were aiming to eliminate all metaphysics, all religious language, all ethical language from the realm of cognitive meaningfulness, reduce them all to expressions of emotion or something like that, on the ground of reason, on the ground of rational investigation. But now when you start to ask the positivist what is the basis for his own theory, you find that, as Ayer himself says, A.J. Ayer, one of the important writers of the school, as Ayer himself came to see in his later writings, he came to see that the verification principle was a convention, and that's the word that he uses, a convention. Well, you see, it all boils down then to convention. It all boils down to not to reason, not to a principle that's firmly established and that everybody has to agree with. It boils down to a convention, and not a convention that's held by everybody that ever lived. It's a convention that's held by a number of academic philosophers and scientists, and which on that account is highly dubious. Now, I'd like to move into the next phase of language analysis, which commonly known as ordinary language philosophy. For those of you who are visiting with us, we're sort of going through a survey of contemporary philosophy, and right at the moment we're studying a broad general movement known as language analysis. These are philosophers who try to solve philosophical problems by giving attention to language. And we've discussed two forms of that now. We've discussed logical atomism and logical positivism, and now we're coming into a somewhat later phase. Sorry, did I pull anything out there? Somewhat later phase known as ordinary language philosophy. Now, I told you about Ludwig Wittgenstein, this rather mysterious fellow who studied philosophy with Bertrand Russell and very quickly became a tremendously influential thinker, wrote the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which was adopted by many, tremendously influential on logical positivism and also the Bible of logical atomism. Well, I told you that Wittgenstein left philosophy in the early 20s for various reasons, perhaps some of them psychological and personal, but others and not separated from the psychological and personal ones either would be the philosophical reason that he felt that he had been reduced to silence by his own philosophical scheme. He felt that what he had said was to show that philosophical utterances were essentially nonsense and that therefore he shouldn't utter them anymore. But as I told you, he performed a number of non-philosophical jobs during that period of time. Then in 1929, for various reasons which are kind of, slightly obscure, Wittgenstein returned to philosophy. Wittgenstein had never been a logical positivist. He had never accepted the positivist use of his Tractatus, although he had some affinities with them, naturally. As he returned to philosophy, he continued for a time to set forth some of the basic ideas of the Tractatus, but very soon, and this seems to become very evident in the early 30s, certainly his lectures in 1933 clearly show this tendency. The blue and the brown books were written about that time. Wittgenstein began to develop a somewhat different way of thinking about language. Now, there are all kinds of arguments about the unity and diversity between Wittgenstein I and Wittgenstein II, between the early Wittgenstein and the late Wittgenstein, and I won't trouble you with those things, but I just want to make sure you know that Wittgenstein himself made that distinction, that Wittgenstein himself felt that there were certain areas in his previous thinking that would have to be changed. So that he did recognize that he himself was embarking on a new path. Now, there are all kinds of parallels and similarities between the two phases, but I'm going to present this new phase as a distinct kind of philosophy, and that's really about all we'll have time to do in our discussion here. Now, perhaps the slogan of the new philosophy, Wittgenstein II, the later Wittgenstein, probably the best slogan is the slogan that's found in Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations, where he says that for a very large number of cases where we use the term meaning, we can say this: the meaning of a sentence is its use in the language. Or the meaning of a word is its use in the language, but the meaning of anything is its use in the language. You remember this is very different from the atomist idea. The atomist idea of words become meaningful by virtue of a one-to-one correspondence between sentences and facts, between words and things, or words and properties, words and relations. There has to be a one-to-one correspondence between words and things in the world, according to logical atomism. Now here you have a rather, then in logical positivism, you have this notion that the meaning of a sentence is its method of verification. But now you come to this third form of language analysis, and you have still a different concept of what constitutes meaning. Meaning is use in general. Now Wittgenstein seemed to have felt that there were some exceptions to that rule, but he seemed to feel that there were exceptions to every rule, but generally this is his slogan, that meaning is use. In other words, what are you looking for? When you look for the meaning, say, of a biblical text, let's say you're trying to translate a verse out of the Gospel of John, let's say you're translating John 3:16, what are you looking for when you look for the meaning of that verse? Well, says Wittgenstein, you're looking to find its use. You're looking to find out how the author makes use of that sentence. And furthermore, you're looking to find out how we should make use of that sentence today. Now, probably if you're very alert, you will note a certain parallelism between the slogan, meaning is use, and the slogan, theology is application. And I say that by way of confession. If any of see that parallel and you want to write a paper saying, well, Frame gets his whole idea from Wittgenstein and so on and so forth, I don't want you to feel that I'm hiding anything. I don't want you to feel that I'm shoving anything under the rug. There certainly is that parallel. I think that, of course, my emphasis is different from Wittgenstein's at any number of places. But I do think that non-Christian philosophers, by virtue of their creation in the image of God, by virtue of borrowed capital, say, put all those qualifications on it that Van Til tells us to put on, but by virtue of all those things, they do at times make valid observations. They observe that trees are green, and they observe that Saturn has rings, and they observe that Mercury is the closest planet to the sun, and they tell us all sorts of things that we probably wouldn't know if we had to depend on Christian sources exclusively. So that's a shame, you know. I suppose that Christians ought to be the leaders in all of these fields, but as a matter of fact, very often we have to learn things from non-Christians, and we have to be critical about that. We can't just make assumptions that they're saying the same things we want to say. We have to bring everything to the test of Scripture, but nevertheless, it happens occasionally that when you see, when you read something in a textbook written by a non-Christian, it does seem to have some validity to it, and it tells you something that you can make use of. Now, having made all those apologies, let's find out what Wittgenstein is up to here. Meaning is use. Well, first of all, the later Wittgenstein rejects the so-called picture theory of language, the idea that language, in order to be meaningful, ought to be a picture of reality. You know, when you think about that, look at a sentence. Well, a sentence does not look very much like reality, does it? The sentence, "the book is on the table," it doesn't look like a book. It doesn't look like a table. It doesn't look like a, you know, it doesn't have very, very much to do. Now, Wittgenstein said, of course, anything can be a picture of anything if you use the right method of projection. You know, I can draw a square up there and tell you that's a picture of a piano, and I can say that this side represents the keys, and this side represents the legs, and this side represents the bench, and so on and so forth. You get the idea. But, you know, in the ordinary sense of the term picture, language does not picture reality. Language does not look very much like reality. Furthermore, you cannot draw a one-to-one correspondence between a set of absolutely simple facts and a set of absolutely simple sentences. It's just impossible in the final analysis to determine what those facts are. You know, when the logical atomists broke down all the complex facts into the simple facts, and they said, well, you know, the really simple facts, the really simple sense data that we have are sentences like "red patch now," you know. And then people started thinking about that a little bit, and they started saying to one another, you know, I've never seen any of those red patches. I've never had an experience of just looking out and seeing a color, you know. Colors are kind of, you know, abstractions from things, aren't they, in a way? I mean, what is redness? How do I know about redness? Well, I know about redness because I've seen a lot of red shirts and ties and sweaters and what else is red in this place? Well, whatever. Really, you know, it's not at all clear which of these things is primary. You know, do we build up our complex perceptions out of these simple red patches and things, or do we get ideas about red patches by breaking down the complex? You know, the complex is the initial datum, and the other things are sort of abstracted from that. Well, you know, that question, when you put it in that kind of way, becomes sort of insoluble, really. So Wittgenstein came to reject that whole idea of reducing complexes to simples. He pointed out in his illustration of the chessboard, you know, what are the simple elements of the chessboard? Well, is it that the chessboard is composed of such and such squares, you know? Is it that it's composed of this layer of paper and then that layer of paper and then another layer of cardboard and so on and so forth? Is it that it's composed of two halves and the representing the two sides initially? It all depends, you know, on what you're trying to do with the concept of simplicity, what you call simple and what you call complex. If you break it down into squares, which I suppose is the most natural thing to do, do you say then that those red squares are combinations of other colors, or do you take red as a primitive term? Well, it's not at all clear just what is the simple and what is the complex. And so, for reasons of this kind, the whole atomist program was called into question. Now, the alternative then is this idea that meaning is reference, that there's a one-to-one correspondence between a piece of language and that to which it refers. Now, when you think about that, for one thing, a language is not does not merely have the function of referring. Language does a lot of things besides refer. Now, it's true that you can use a word like book to refer to that particular book. That's one thing that we do with language. There are lots of other things that we do with language too. We exclaim, we command, we put people under arrest, we give promises to one another. There are lots of kinds of language that are not simply the stating of facts. You see, language has many functions other than merely stating facts, and words have many functions other than merely referring. Wittgenstein then, in his later thinking, comes to a much more complex idea of what constitutes meaning. Meaning is achieved in many ways in language. Some language does have that job of referring to facts, of stating facts. Other forms of language have other jobs. And Wittgenstein says that when he really started to think of the variety of things that are done in language, he was really quite astounded by it. Here the philosophers had done all this work on the assumption that language has only one function, only one job, to refer to facts. And says Wittgenstein, no, they have many, many different functions, such as telling stories, promising, thanking, cursing, praying, greeting, joking, theorizing, pretending. I'm just reading a small portion of a very long list that he gives to us in the part of his philosophical investigations. Well, on this basis, then, the limits of the sayable become very greatly enlarged. The limits of the sayable become very greatly enlarged. It becomes now possible to talk about ethics and religion again. You see, before, we had the analysts had decided that the religious language and ethical language were at least cognitively meaningless. But now, you see, the whole thing is expanded somewhat. We don't say that religious and ethical language are cognitively meaningless. We say it has meaning because it has a use, all right? It may not be the same kind of meaning that you get in scientific statements, any more than a command is the same as an indicative. But it has a meaning, it has a function, it has a use in the language. People do, make use of it. And Wittgenstein himself felt that he didn't have much use for the concept of God, but he looked around and found that other people did have a use for it. And so he declared that this language was meaningful because it did have a function, it did have a use within a particular community. We find then, at least on the surface, a much greater toleration of religious language. All right, let's look over some of these things, see if I've caught some of these emphases under meaning as used. First, the rejection of the picture theory. Rejection of the idea of a perfect language. There is no perfect language anymore. There are only various languages which are constructed for various purposes. There's no single language which is best for all purposes. There's no single language which is the criterion of truth for all the others. All right, then secondly, Wittgenstein is very suspicious of generalizations about language. He doesn't like people to say that all language does this or all language does this. He's very wide open to the varieties in language. Doesn't like the idea, for instance, that where you have a single word being used, that there's always a kind of single core of meaning that's attached to that single word. Like the term game, for instance. This is one of his illustrations. People sometimes say, well, you know, we use the word game for so many different things. We use the word game for baseball and for football and soccer. We also use it for children's games like Ring Around the Rosie, and we use it for we use games for in various figurative senses and so on and so forth. Now, somebody says, well, now look, all of these uses of the term game, they must have something in common. You know, they must designate together a kind of essence that takes various forms, to be sure, in these different situations, but there must be a common essence. There must be something in common to all of those uses of the term game. And that's kind of a Platonic way of arguing, you know. Plato thought, well, look, we use this term green and so on. It must designate something or other. It doesn't designate the greenness in this particular tree or that particular tree, so it must designate something up in the world of forms. That's one of the arguments for the forms, you see, in Plato. Well, Wittgenstein is going at that, and he's saying, well, maybe there is no single essence that's referred to in every use of the term game. Now, maybe the term game has a variety of uses that kind of overlap one another in various ways, but also have very significant differences. He uses the illustration of a family reunion. Maybe some of you were having family reunions yesterday at Thanksgiving. Well, the family gets together, and you can tell that there are family resemblances, that there's a kind of... In the frame reunion, there's a kind of frame look. And what does that involve? Well, it doesn't mean that everybody has red hair. Maybe some of them do, some of them don't. Maybe some of them have a certain shape of nose that's distinctive, but not all of them do. Some of them would have a certain, cut of the hairline, certain shape of the face, a certain way in which their eyes look, and so on and so forth. But not all of them will have all of these features. Some of them will have some features, some of them will have the nose, some of them will have the eyes, some of them will have the jaw, some of them will have the hair, and so on and so forth, but none of them will have all of these features. The features overlap and they crisscross. One guy will have both the nose and the ears, and you say, oh yeah, I know him, he belongs to that family. Another guy won't have either the nose or the ears, but he'll have the hair and the chin. So you say, oh yeah, he belongs to that family too, even though these two people have none of these distinctive features in common. So Wittgenstein says, let's look at the term game in a little bit in that way, you know. You try to figure out various essences, you try to figure out various basic definitions for the term. You know, a game involves winning and losing. Well, what about Ring Around the Rosie, says Wittgenstein? Does that involve winning and losing? Probably not, unless you skin your knees or something on the ground. What about tossing a ball around? Does that involve winning and losing? Well, no. So somebody says, well, it always involves competitiveness, and then you find some game where people just, play for fun. Well, okay, so it's very difficult to find one single characteristic. It's common to all games, but you can find an overlapping of characteristics similar to that family resemblance situation. And so, and Wittgenstein called these family resemblances. In some games you have winning and losing, and some games you have, you play them with balls and you kick balls around, and some games you have scores, and some games you have fun, amusement. Other games you pursue it relentlessly for money, even though you're not having any fun, But there are all these characteristics, and they overlap and they crisscross. And in some cases, you'll have two or three of them together. In another case, you'll have a different two or three of them together. And so you say, well, all right, there is no essence. There is no single characteristic that's found in all games, but there's an overlap of characteristics found in many games. Now, this kind of thinking is having an influence on biblical scholarship now, particularly through the work of James Barr and others, and you'll be getting some of this, I trust, in your later studies in the Old and New Testament. It used to be that there was quite an emphasis on etymologies in studying the Bible. People would say, if you want to find out what righteousness means, you ought to look up the etymology of the word righteousness and find out what it meant way back at the very beginning of its usage. And then you sort of figure, well, due to that history, there must be sort of a, that ancient usage must sort of filter down so that the biblical writers must sort of have that in the back of their minds. They must kind of have the etymological meaning in the back of their minds as they write. We ought to do that too. Well, now scholars are very suspicious of that way of operating. They say, no, let's not trace the history of a word back to its etymology. Let's rather see how people were using words at that time, See how the Apostle Paul uses the word righteousness. He may use it in a word in a way very different from its etymology. He may use it in a very different way from the way somebody else uses it. The uses will have some connection historically. They may have some family resemblance between them, but there won't be necessarily a carryover of meaning from one type of usage to another. You do get that kind of emphasis now in biblical studies, and I think to a great extent it's a very useful and helpful approach. Okay, so the concept of family resemblances, then three, there's an emphasis against reductionism. I told you already that Wittgenstein is against trying to reduce complexes to simples the way the atomists did. Wittgenstein also insists that there's no need to reduce vague expressions to precise expressions. If a photographer calls you over and tells you to stand roughly there, stand over in that area, that's not, he's telling you what he wants you to do. That's not a confused sentence. That's a very clear sentence. He's stating exactly what's on his mind. You can't put that sentence into superior form by saying that what he really means is that you should stand 4.023 yards from the wall. That's not what he means, and that's not what he said. What he means is to stand roughly there. That's the meaning, the meaning of that. It's perfectly meaningful in that form. You don't need to reduce the vague to the precise. I've made a little bit of use of that principle too in talking about Scripture, and advocating Scripture is not does not become erroneous simply because it uses round numbers or simply because it uses vague expressions. Scripture does not become unclear because it does that, and it doesn't become erroneous. It tells us exactly what God wants us to know. And if I can be paradoxical, it tells us what God wants us to know precisely, even though it uses rather vague expressions sometimes. So that there's no need to feel that because there are vaguenesses in the Bible that we have to abandon inerrancy, nor is there any need to say that because there are vaguenesses in the Bible, the theologian has to somehow take the Bible and put it into better form, the theologian has to take these sort of vague expressions and reduce them to precise, clear, sharp expressions. Now, that kind of work might be entirely superfluous. So you see how this ties in with things we've been saying about theology. Okay, for the extra-linguistic context, Wittgenstein insists that if you're going to understand what a word means, you have to understand it not only in the context of other words. In other words, if you want to, if you want to understand John 3:16, don't merely look at its relationships to verses 1 through 15 and verses 17 through whatever it is, but also look at the extra-linguistic context. Look at the culture of the time. Look at the writer. Look at the way he lived. Look at the early church. Try to see how that verse would have functioned in the early church. How would they have used that verse? What value would they have found in it? What would they have done with it? How would it have profited them in their lives? Well, again, theology is application. You can see the parallels there. The concept of therapy. Wittgenstein had a very limited concept of philosophy here in his later phases. He certainly did not think anymore that philosophy could discover the overall structure of the world. He seemed to feel that in his earlier phase, that through investigating the structure of language and purifying language by logic, you could discover the the way the world is, the actual structure of facts and so on. But now he no longer feels that way. He's become a little bit more of a positivist, a little bit more opposed to metaphysics, opposed to positive constructive philosophy. But he does feel that philosophy has one important purpose, and that is to cure us of confusions. A typical example of this that he uses in various places is with regard to the word time. I think I've probably used this illustration with you before. The word time is a word that we use very easily in life. I ask you what time it is, you look at your watch and tell me. Somebody tells me it's past time to start, and so I look at the clock and see that's true, and I start lecturing. Somebody tells me, no, we can't do this job, we don't have enough time. Well, we work that out in various ways. We lighten the tasks, or we move the deadline back, or we exhort one another, or whatever we need to do. So we all know how to use the word time in ordinary language, but now imagine somebody comes up to you and says, well, can you define the word time? You think you know what time is. Well, can you define it? You sort of scratch your head on that. You think, no, time, what in the world? What in the world is time? Augustine had that problem, and Wittgenstein quotes Augustine. Wittgenstein read Augustine and Kierkegaard and a lot of other figures that you wouldn't expect him to read, I guess, at first glance. But Wittgenstein quotes Augustine. Augustine says, what is time? If nobody asks me, I know. But if somebody asks me, I don't know. And Wittgenstein thought that that was a good example of a philosophical problem. Philosophical problems arise when these perfectly ordinary words that we use every day, we have no trouble using them, when people start asking for general definitions, or they start asking for to find the referent, you know, what does the word time refer to? There must be something back there that you can connect it with, you know, the atomists did. Well, says Wittgenstein, you know, at that point, it's like you have a disease. It's like it's something afflicting you. You're really asking questions that can't be answered. And if you try to answer them, then you're really falling into the trap. What you want to do is to show that there's really no question here to be answered. You want to show that, look, what is time? Well, all you need to do is list its uses. All you need to do is list the uses of the word. Once you've shown how we use it, here's this situation where we use it, here's another use, and so on and so forth. After you see that, after you see these different situations where we use the term time, we know what time is. There is nothing more. You don't need to look for a referent. The word does not have a referent. You can use it to refer to various situations, but it doesn't have a referent kind of attached to it. It doesn't need to be the name of a thing. Lots of words are not names of things. It's just a word that we have a use for in our language, and beyond that, there are no questions to be asked. So according to Wittgenstein, philosophy is and ought to be therapy. It ought to be a way of curing these sicknesses, curing these confusions that we get into. Now, there are others, of course, in Wittgenstein's circle, people like for instance, P.F. Strawson, who have, and J.L. Austin, who's another important language philosopher, who see matters a little differently. Now, there's one sentence in Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations where he says, look, once we find out how language is used, we see how the world is. Now, of course, Wittgenstein meant that in a very negative kind of way, that once you get all your confusions cleared, then you can see the world clearly without asking all these dumb questions anymore. But in Austin and Strawson and some of these people, you have the idea that the analysis of language can be the gateway to still a new metaphysics. That once you understand how words are used, you really do see the structure, you know. You can tell how the world is. You can accurately picture the way the world really is. Through an analysis of the use of the term time, You can really, now maybe Wittgenstein and Strawson are not saying anything different, but there's a difference in emphasis here. The one says, well, you know, we really shouldn't pay any attention to these traditional philosophical problems. The other group says, yes, we should pay attention to them, and we find our answers by analyzing the use of words. So Wittgenstein's type of approach can be used in an anti-metaphysical direction, or it can be pushed in a metaphysical direction. It can be pushed, if you will, in an irrationalistic direction or in a rationalistic direction. Well, let's look at some of the implications of this for religious language. Religious language is one particular type of use. And it's rather odd in some ways. Let's see, is that, all of you see that pretty well? It's odd in some ways. Of course, all language has some kind of oddness because any form of language is different from other forms of language. Religious language has a strange status with regard to verification, and here the flu type of problem re-enters again. These more recent philosophers are not inclined to say that religious language is meaningless. And they're not even inclined to say that it's cognitively meaningless. They're willing to say that it asserts facts, if you will. But they also want to say that you verify religious statements in such a different way from the way you verify other statements. That religious facts, if there are religious facts, are a very odd kind of fact, are terribly different from other kinds of facts. And so they very often, of course, I'm just generalizing about the school now, but very often it's felt that religious sentences bear on a very narrow, circumscribed area of life. They bear on a very narrow, circumscribed area of life. So you can use this language, you know, in certain situations. You can use it when you're worshiping on Sunday. You can worship it. You can use it when you're praying. You can use it when you're reading your Bible. But you better not bring it into your scientific work, you see, because then you're bringing in two different kinds of language together. You're using religious language in a way that was never designed to be used. And so you're getting yourself mixed up in all kinds of pseudo-problems and confusions for which you need a cure, all right? So the idea then works in the direction of compartmentalization, narrowing the scope of religious language to one small area of human life. That, of course, is an idea that I've been campaigning against this whole term and arguing that the Bible bears upon all areas of life and should not be restricted in that kind of way. Secondly, there's the assertion that religious language, you find this in Wittgenstein's Lectures and Conversations, but religious language does not deal in possibilities or probabilities. Now, this is in itself is a statement that pertains only to certain kinds of religious language, but take the existence of God, for instance. Wittgenstein saw that Christians are very reluctant to say that God possibly exists or God probably exists. Where have we heard that before, huh? Has he seen something? Well, maybe he has. He hadn't visited very many theological seminaries, you know, and theological seminaries, people do talk about the possibility of the resurrection and the probability of the existence of God, but religious people don't very often talk that way, and the Bible doesn't very often talk that way, and here Wittgenstein sees things better than a lot of theologians do, it seems to me. He recognizes that typically, at least, religious language deals with certainties, not with the possibilities and probabilities, and this is one thing that makes it odd, because even though you don't have scientific evidence for it, nevertheless, you assert these things with great certainty. Wittgenstein thought that was very strange. well, I think consideration of the role of presuppositions will help you to see what's behind that.